The Frequency 49 show is brought to you by Niner Empire GB.
Welcome to the Frequency 49 show. I'm Paul McDonald. What's the best way to celebrate beating the Seahawks twice in the regular season? Beat them again in the postseason, of course. The 49ers kicked Pete Carroll and the Seahawks out of the playoffs with a convincing win on the back of a second half that saw the 49ers outscore the Seahawks 25-6 after finishing the first half 1 point down. Brock Purdy continued his path to greatness, this time rushing for a touchdown as well as throwing three of them to Deebo Samuel, Elijah Mitchell and Christian McCaffrey. On the defensive side of the ball, Dre Greenlaw led the 49ers with 11 tackles and the Niners sacked Geno Smith three times. After that, a Lenoir interception and a forced fumble from Omenihu and the 49ers had a pretty impressive game all round. Joining me today to discuss the game are Deepak Gohill and Michael Wandai. Good afternoon, fellas.
Good evening, Paul.
Hello from Germany.
It's still afternoon in Liverpool.
Well, <Okay, yeah. laughs> So, a pretty impressive game. On the whole, on Saturday night.
Yeah, and Paul, I mean, I just want to flag this up. On the last recording that we did together, we did sort of call it, didn't we? We said there'd be a lot of toing and froing in the first half, and then the second half we would pull away. And I think we really need to have a closer look at that first half, because we'd gone in from being potentially 2 points up at halftime to being one down. We just committed suicide, you know, and the playoffs are very unforgiving. And I think, you know, had we not made that turnover when it was still a 6 point game, we could have been in deep doo doo in that game. Momentum changes are so critical.
Do you think that for the first half, Pete Carroll came in with a plan to beat the 49ers and it was working for the Seahawks and they just ran out of steam? Or was it the second half changes that were made by Kyle Shanahan and the players on the field that meant that the second half was completely the 49ers?
I mean, before I defer to Michael for his answer, my version of that would be two things. Yes, Shanny made adjustments, but player for player, we were just too good for them. You know, we were just too good for them. And I think that was the difference that made the difference, you know. And if you look at, it's the turnovers, it's the scoring immediately from the first drive after returning the kickoff in the third quarter to start the second half. And little things like that, it's turnovers will break the spirit of a team, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's what led to a permanent shift in momentum. So I do believe it's two things. I do believe Shanny takes a lot of credit for the adjustments that he made, but I also think that our players prevailed, you know, that we have a really good team.
Michael, do you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, I think what happened in the first half was the Seahawks pretty much lulled us into believing we could go there and win without any effort. Plus, we had nervous players. You could see that with Purdy, who was nervous. Still, he had some good plays, but you could see how nervous he was. Yeah. You could see it with some other players. And then, of course, this famous interview where Pete Carroll said the 49ers are loaded, and I think, like always, that went into the minds of the players and who thought, oh, we only need to do what is necessary to beat them. Hmm. And then in the second half, I think Deebo said it best, the situation where Abram tried to twist his ankle, that was a situation when the team said, okay, we take our foot from the brake and give them everything we have. And after that point, they couldn't win anymore against us.
Yeah.
Michael, let me ask you a question. Do you think Pete Carroll was playing mind games with this?
Absolutely.
Oh my God, we've got the 49ers. And the other question is, do you think he actually told his players to try and hurt Debo and other vulnerable players? Because I believe he did.
To answer your first question, yes. Pete Carroll is one of the most successful and most experienced coach in the league. And I think if there are coaches who can play mind games, it's Pete Carroll and Bill Belichick. And the second thing is, yes, I think the rivalry between the Seahawks and the Niners is so great that that they do that on purpose. Still saying the Cowboys-Niners rivalry is bigger than the Seahawks, but yeah, I think they would do it.
See, for us old people, I don't really consider the Seahawks to be rivals. For me, it's always going to be the Rams, it's going to be the Cowboys and the New York Giants. I still see Seattle as an AFC team for some reason. I've never bought into that rivalry with them because they haven't earned the right to be our rivals, whereas being in the same division as the Rams and everything else that goes with it, and also the rivalry with the Cowboys that extends back into the 80s as well as the mid-90s as well. You know, it's legitimate rivals. We do not like them, and I don't think there's anybody who knows us would argue that we do not like them. We do not.
You asked people the two questions that you asked. I can't even remember what the first question was.
Well, the question was about the mind games.
Yes. So yeah, definitely, definitely, what Pete Carroll said was mind games. He has been a master of mind games, and he knows that the Seahawks have had the measure of the 49ers over the past few seasons. This season's been different, but yeah, definitely mind games. As far as Pete Carroll instructing the Seahawks players to hurt 49ers players, I'm going to say no on that one. But I wouldn't have put it past Pete Carroll to say to his players, or to highlight to his players, how few penalties had been called up to that point.
Yeah.
There were virtually no penalties. In kind of, you can get away with pretty much anything you want out there, boys. And that situation with Debo Samuel and the ankle twisting, as Michael said, fired up the 49ers.
Did you hear Debo's interview?
He said, you know, that is going to fire us up. And Debo is not the person that you do that to. He's going to come back. And the 49ers did. It had the exact effect that they didn't want it to have. And the 49ers went out and did what we did in the second half.
See, in the interview, he actually said, I deliberately stayed down because if I'd got up, I was going to have at it. He'd lost his temper. He'd lost his rag.
Yeah, that shows intelligence in Debo Samuel, that he didn't get up and respond, because as we know, the first player to respond to something like that is the first player that's flagged.
Yeah, and then the George Kittle interview about the same incident, he was in disbelief. He goes, why would you want to upset somebody? He goes, why would you want to upset Trent Williams? That man's, he'll kill you. Why would you go after somebody like Trent, you know, by doing this? Because it really is, everyone's got everyone's back. And the melee that happened, even Shanny got onto the pitch and he sort of bumped a Seahawk out of the way, you know, which was pretty good to see, you know, because the team let it be known. But the thing that struck me about that incident was that not a flag was thrown.
I know, yeah.
No flags were thrown. And that sort of told me that they're not really going to let these guys play, but they really want the game to be played with certain advantages for some and not for others. And that was the distinct feeling that I got when I saw that there was no flag, because it was so obvious that why would you not flag that? You know, I mean, it's basic football. You know, it's unsportsmanlike conduct for a start, you know.
Do you think the refs were instructed pre-game by the league, let this game be a slobber knocker? Let this game be the TV draw. It was the first game of the football weekend, so it's gonna, you know, it's got the ratings, and yeah, I'm wondering whether the refs were told don't be so happy with your flags. Let this game play out. Let it get a little bit chippy either side.
But you see, you can say that about letting holding calls go or pass interference calls go, but this was flagrant unsportsmanlike.
Oh, I agree.
Unsportsmanlike behaviour. You can't really. I mean, these are fellow professionals, so they all understand to one another the value and importance of having a healthy career because it's their livelihood. They get, you know, it's how they feed their family with expensive food, no doubt. But you understand what I'm saying. You know, they have that code amongst themselves where they respect the profession, you know. So when that wasn't called, it actually did make me think that it was a deliberate non-call to see what would happen, to see if it would spice a game up that doesn't really need any more spice. You know, it's pretty tasty as it is.
Yeah.
I'm be honest, if I would have been an NFL ref, I would flag any holding. If I see it, I flag it, because the holding is giving the offense an advantage. And everyone who played offense lineman like me knows how to do covered holdings. Why do you do open holdings and get away with it? Yeah. That's what I don't understand with the NFL. O-linemen have enough ideas how to cover a holding. For example, pushing the pad up to the what is Hals in English? Wait a second.
Yeah, Google Translate.
Yeah, I know. To the neck. If you put the pads up to the neck, you basically suffocate your opponent and he lets a bit loose. So you have an advantage and you don't hold. So that's what I did as an O-lineman, and I hope nobody who played against me hears that.
But also, I think there's a fair amount of holding on every single play. Every down, on every play, there is holding. I mean, the ones that I think are far more fun to spot are the defensive backs that do the holding and the shoving and the pushing that don't get called within the 5-yard contact zone that they're allowed to have before separation. And some of those calls are insane because it then makes you wonder about pass interference. You know, is it the cheapest penalty in all of sports? Shouldn't it be capped at a certain distance rather than you just lob a Hail Mary?
In college, where it is only a 50-yard penalty and not a spot penalty.
Spot penalty, exactly. You know, and I think if you can play the pass interference penalty well, you're going to move the ball upfield when you really have got no right to be doing that, you know. I don't know. But we may see examples of these things as the weekend unfolds because, again, I know this sounds so conspiracy theorist and I'm not a tinfoil hat where I'm not a conspiracist, but the ingredients are there for whoever wins the Super Bowl to have a special edge. I mean, for us, it would be Brock Purdy, you know, Mr. Irrelevant. Leads a team to win a Super Bowl, you know, he's a quarterback of a Super Bowl winning team, goes unbeaten in order to do it. I mean, what a story. That would be talked about as much as Joe Montana has been talked about. That would be talked about as much as the comebacks and everything else, you know. It's a huge
all the deal. Steve Young Super Bowl when Steve Young stepped out of Joe Montana's shadow.
Yeah, see, this sort of thing, this sort of story that the NFL like to have in their champions, you know, it makes me think if we win it, you know, I'd want us to win it in the most honest way possible. But I think there might be some elements of, you know, let this slide, let that slide, make life a little easier on these guys, but not those guys, you know, that sort of thing. And and it sort of does tie in because the NFL is now really, it's not a sport anymore. It's more of an entertainment package, you know.
And Brock Purdy already is in a Cinderella story. Yeah. I mean, look at the stats he had at this game. They were Joe Montana-like, the stats he had. He is one of 11 quarterbacks who had at least 300 yards passing and at least one rushing touchdown in a playoff game, and in this 11 quarterback, there are two other 49ers quarterbacks, Joe Montana and Jeff Garcia, that guy already is a Cinderella story, and if he wins the Super Bowl, he isn't the first Mr. Irrelevant who wins the Super Bowl. That ship is sailed by a kicker, but he would be the first Mr. Irrelevant quarterback who wins the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and played in every game to get there, you know, and play well. I think that is really the story, whichever way you paint it. I'm trying to think who else has a story. Philly doesn't have a backstory. The Cowboys will never have a backstory. End of story. That's just not happening. The Cowboys won't have a backstory. I'm thinking it's either us or perhaps Buffalo for what they've gone through. You know, let's give them a Super Bowl. That'd be a nice little story for them. You know, I just want the teams to win it in an honest competition. That's all. But a part of me thinks that that's not really the way it's going to play out. I don't know. Maybe I'm too cynical.
Well, the second half for Purdy, he was 9 of 11 for 185 yards, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions, and a 158.3 passer rating. That was in the second half.
Yeah.
That's incredible. The 49ers won 11 straight games now. Purdy has won, is it 6 of them straight now?
Yep. This
one's... As a starter, 6 as a starter, and 7, the 7th where he came on and won the game. And it's the 7th consecutive game with multiple passing touchdowns. He's thrown for 2 touchdowns or more in every game he's played so far.
I think Trent Williams was a little bit disingenuous with what he said. I think he meant to praise Purdy, but what he actually said was, he's doing what we need to win. You know, he's doing what we need. I think, you know, Trent should be lucky that his mate Jimmy's not QB, otherwise we may not even be in this stage in the season in the playoffs. You know, I think Brock Purdy is not doing what he needs to win. I think he's finding ways to help us win. He's extending plays, he's doing creative things. I mean, the greatest incompletion in 49er history was when he threw to Brandon Ayuk, and Ayuk just couldn't hold on to the ball. But that pass was insane. It was astonishing that he got the ball off. And if you ever watch the replay, it looks like a lot like the pass that Montana threw to Dwight Clark, except this wasn't a looper, this was a bullet. And he had defensive linemen rushing right at him. He kept his composure, he took a massive hit, and I just couldn't hold on in the corner of the end zone. If that had been a completion, that would have been the catch 3 right there and then, yeah. Even though it wasn't a game decider.
I have to say, at the moment, Brock Purdy is everything fans hope from Trey. He extends the game by being mobile. He is accurate in passing. He's everything people expected from Trey Lance.
But genuinely, the last time I think the faithful were this excited about a quarterback was probably Kaepernick's first season, 2 seasons perhaps.
You
know?
Yeah.
And then we all know what happened to Kaepernick after that. He just sort of withered and just became, irrelevant.
Also, I think there's a difference between Kaepernick and Brock Purdy at the moment, and that's the behavior off field. I think Brock Purdy has his head between his shoulders, and Kaepernick grew with the fan support. He started believing he is without any error, and I think that's the difference. I think when you start thinking you're better than some of your coaches, and I heard this from a lot of coaches with Kaepernick, that he thought he is better than some of his coaches, you don't do any step in the right direction. But if you still have your head between your shoulders, you will advance in this game.
But also, you know, you also have to look at players. And again, I'm going to talk about this guy because I think he is just awesome. I'm talking about Trent Williams. For somebody like him, this might be one of his last opportunities to win a ring. You know, so Brock Purdy's progression is as important to him as it is to Brock Purdy himself. You know, this might be Trent Williams' last chance to win it. He might even decide to retire, you know?
Yeah, and Fred Warner. I mean, Fred Warner didn't say that about Jimmy Garoppolo. He said it about Brock Purdy. He said Brock Purdy is a reason we're still having a chance to win it all.
100%. He actually did say that. He goes, he's the reason. That's very different to saying he's doing what we need him to do. You know, that's very different. But
So,
again, this, the whole thing with, if you remember Kittle in particular, the whole Jimmy G loving that the players had for him, this over syrupy adoration of him in the media, you know, I wonder whether it was just in bad taste or whether they really did love this guy, because this kid deserves that adoration right now. But maybe if you gave it to him, like you said, Michael, it could go straight to his head and he thinks he's better than he already is. So it's better to keep this kid grounded for as long as possible, because one of the biggest development points in any quarterback's career is how do they handle losing. Right now, we're in a position where we don't have that luxury of needing to find that out at this point. You know, let him lose a regular season game next season, but not now. Between now and February, he's not allowed to lose any.
Yeah, I think I believe what the players say about Jimmy. I think the thing is, you can be a leader on the field, which Jimmy was, but you can have a limited talent. And Jimmy had limited talent. And the same way they are now looking toward Brock is because Brock is a leader on and off the field too, with a little bit more talent at the moment than Jimmy had. And that's the difference.
No, I disagree. I think he's got a ton more talent than Jimmy has. I mean, Brock destroyed Jimmy's ceiling in the Miami game. You know, the game was over then.
I tried to be modest to keep Brock leveled if he hears a podcast.
I really hope Brock is listening, but I think, you know, that there are a lot of comparisons made about him, but I think it's just a question of keep developing him. And also, if you look at the coach, the amount of trust that he puts on Purdy's shoulders, he really does place a great deal of trust on Brock Purdy, more so than I've seen him place on Jimmy and even Trey Lance. You know, he likes Purdy. He believes Purdy can execute those plays, which, you know, apart from a few jittery moments, Purdy has done a great job of doing it and making difficult plays. I mean, that one where he threw it to Christian McCaffrey, it was by the goal line. I think it was even in the red zone. He got flushed out of the pocket and you think, where's he going to go? And he runs and he does a fake. And before you know it, McCaffrey's all by himself and he literally just tossed it to him and said, here you go, buddy. Off you pop.
You can see it in the behavior. I mean, the one thing I really despised about Jimmy, he threw an interception, walks off the field and is grinning. He grins after an interception. Brock doesn't throw an interception, but he is close to be intercepted. And you see he walks off the field and you really can read his lips saying, what the did you do there, Brock? And that's the difference. He is challenging himself, unlike Jimmy did.
But to stick up for Jimmy, I think, you know, that's how some players handle it. But also, when Brock throws a bad throw or a near interception, or even if he gets sacked, if you notice the very next play, he's thrown a money ball that's gone some yards, you know. And I think what Brock was trying to do too much in the first half against the Seahawks was throw that home run ball, where he doesn't actually need to do that because we've got guys that are capable of totting up the yak yards. He doesn't have to throw it 90 yards in the air. He can throw it 15-20 yards in the air and it will still go for 90 yards, you know. And I think he needs to get out of that mindset that he needs to lob the deep bomb. He doesn't need to do that.
Yeah.
Looking elsewhere on the 49ers team, somewhere that we've had an issue with over the past few games has been the O-line. The O-line in this game against Seahawks, there were only three pressures by Seahawks in the entire game against the O-line. That, I don't want to say that we've sorted it out overnight, but changes have been made to the O-line, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. But also, Paul, it's a sign of a good team that, you know, we've won 11 straight games, but within those 11 wins are micro wins within the team and micro losses within the team. Yeah. So one of the micro wins is that our O-line play has significantly improved. You know, we do have a few little losses along the way, and these are internal losses, which I'm sure that they'll work on. But I do think the improved O-line play is down to hard work. It's down to putting it into practice. It's down to understanding schemes. It's understanding plays. I think that, you know, they have the offensive line, have Brunskill. All those guys have put a lot of work into this. Aaron Banks has come back from injury. They've all worked really, really hard, and the results are there, you know. But, you know, the micro losses that worries me is our pass defense has disappeared since the Commanders game. And that really worries me. That really, truly frightens the bejesus out of me. It basically means you can pass on us and there's not a damn thing we can do about it.
Yeah.
That kind of message, you know.
I hope D'Amico is addressing that. Although the difference is a different thing. One thing about the O-line, I feel much more secure with the O-line when Aaron Banks is back. I love Spencer Burford, but the O-line looked at best when Aaron Banks played right guard and Brunskill played left guard and Burford just jumped in when he needed to, because those two are a little bit more secure on guard than Burford is. And as I said, I like Burford, but I feel more secure when Aaron Banks is back. And now to the defense, I really think the problem starts up front. The D-line still is a bit... is okay, but they had more pressures before the Washington game too, and I think our D-line, when they step up again, our pass defense will step up again too, because if you pressure the quarterback more, then the cornerbacks have it much easier. And when the problem is when Bosa is blocked or held, mostly held, there is almost no one who steps up and makes them pay for Bosa being held, except for Eric Armstead, and he is a defensive tackle. Yeah. So I think the other defensive ends have to step up and take a bit of pressure from Bosa too, so Bosa can do his thing again. Because if you remember, he had two games to break the team internal sack record and two games to break the NFL sack record, and he didn't have any sack in the last two games. So I think the problem starts in the D-line, and that our defensive coordinator now does interviews this week with potential new head coaching jobs. I hate it. I really hate it. He has to have his head in the game for the Cowboys game and not for some game he may works for in the future.
I think also I'm expecting Nick Bosa to have one of the best games of his career on Sunday. And I'll tell you why. Against the Seahawks, he didn't even get a rush. Not one hurry, nothing. All he managed to do was get... Well, I say all he managed to do. He was double-teamed a lot, but he recovered a fumble. But he didn't get any pressures on the quarterback. And I think that's not going to sit very well with him. I think he's going to go all out on Sunday. And I think we're going to see Bosa play out of his skin. I think he's going to have an immense game on Sunday.
Well, looking forward to Sunday's game. It is the divisional round matchup against those old foes of the 49ers, easy for me to say, the Dallas Cowboys. They're going to be playing at 11:30 kickoff UK time, and that's going to be at Levi Stadium. The last time these teams met was in the wild card round of the 21-22 playoff season, and the 49ers won that game 23-17. Looking at the matchups between the two teams, offensively, 49ers and the Cowboys, they're pretty evenly matched. Defensively, Deepak, something you touched on before, our pass defense. were ranked 20th in pass defense against the Dallas Cowboys' 8th ranking, but rushing yards were ranked 2nd against their 22nd in rushing defense. So maybe that is the key to winning this game. If we can keep the ball on the ground and rush it against their defense, we could have this game in the hat.
We could do, but also, if you look at our offensive weapons, aerial threats in particular, we're talking about C-Mac, who can catch like a receiver and run like a running back. Exact same thing applies to Deebo Samuel. We both know. We all know. He can play running back, he can play receiver, and play both as a pro, an all-pro in both positions. Then you've got George Kittle, who's now finding a new lease of life as a, you know, as somebody who's contributing with the ball rather than just blocking. Brandon Ayuk has come out of himself again. He's improving, getting better with every game. But you know, there's a little secret nuclear weapon that nobody ever talks about, and that's Juszczyk, Juice.
Yeah, you know,
he's seldom used, but when he is, that guy is devastating. And again, I think he's a player that Dallas may not have completely keyed in on, and he may be an afterthought for them. I bet you Shanny incorporates him in a couple of deep throws. I bet you he does, because Juice does get open for those.
And the other factor that we have is Brock Purdy's legs as well. He's shown that he can run. He's rushed for a touchdown himself now. So that's another strength of 49ers' bow.
We have, I mean, you know, the Cowboys, nobody gets to the playoffs by being terrible apart from the Buccaneers, who truly were terrible. They had a losing record. But if you look at teams like the Cowboys, you know, this really is the business end of the playoffs, so to speak. Roster for roster, player for player, there isn't a single team in the NFL that can match a stride for stride in terms of quality. You know, and I think the only team we need to be afraid of, there's only one team I can see that can beat us in this playoff, and that is the San Francisco 49ers. It's actually ourselves.
Yeah. We are opening as 3.5-point favourites for the game. Vegas has this as a tight game, and I've got to agree with them. I think this is going to be a heck of a lot tighter than we have seen over the past few weeks.
Maybe not. I mean, don't forget, they struggled. Dallas have struggled against mediocre teams this season, you know, and only just crossed over the line. A four-point advantage, fair enough. That's basically two scores or one score if it's a touchdown.
Hmm.
I think we'll beat them by more than a touchdown. I think it'll be a 10-point game. But you cannot discount this team completely. I think largely for the neutrals, it's no one knows what they're going to get from either team. But I think for those of us that have watched this 49er team throughout the entire season and seen them become devastating, since Christian McCaffrey came, he was one of the missing pieces in this team. And now we've got a quarterback that can actually deliver the ball with accuracy. Receivers aren't making adjustments in midair and risking injury and then reducing their yak potential because they've had to make adjustments. We're now getting people to hit in stride with accuracy. You know, I think we are stronger than we realize.
Yeah.
And we are pretty strong.
I might have something on this.
Yeah. I just read at Twitter another take that the Cowboys have a plus 125 point differential. The only team the 49ers faced with such a good point differential were the Chiefs, and the 49ers lost. Yeah, that was our third or fourth game,
yeah.
And the team still wasn't where it is now. So I find it funny that people always bring up the Chiefs game when the team was certainly at the bottom.
Yeah, it was our practice squad that played against the Chiefs.
And then
McCaffrey just got off the airplane. I mean,
yeah.
What were they expecting? Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you look at the Cowboys' schedule, I mean, most teams they faced were bad as well. So they have a positive point differential against bad teams, and they almost lost against the Jaguars, and they lost against the Washington Commanders, which we have beaten. So, yeah. And that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, it really is going to be quite an interesting game. I think again, it's going to be a close first half. You know, a lot of toing, a lot of throwing. Both teams, you know, perhaps respecting each other and getting a feel for what they're about. But, you know, the Cowboys coaching are terrible when it comes to time management, clock management, that sort of thing. They're garbage at that.
Remember, I think, garbage at it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as the game goes on, I think the sheer amount of quality we have and the depth of quality we have will impose itself on the game.
One thing I just want to bring up, Dak Prescott's thrown 15 interceptions in 12 games against the 49ers, who lead the league in interceptions with 20 for the season. That could be something interesting. If Prescott's throwing that many interceptions in games, if we can pick up a couple of interceptions in this game, that could wrap the game up completely.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to win the turnover battle, you are going to win the game. But this is the playoffs. This is playoffs. When you get the turnover, you get a touchdown. Their field goals are no good at this level. You know? Yeah,
we can't just run. We can't just take it down the field and settle for a field goal. We need to be getting sevens off those interceptions, if those interceptions do present themselves to us.
Yeah, but if we stop Dallas from scoring, then their kicker can't miss an extra point. So.
Okay, a quick roundup of the pick six for the postseason before we wrap the show up. Weekly winners this week, there were three of them. Danny Hogg, Diana Richards and Mark Lyon all got 14 points off pick sixes. So the table after week one is first place, Danny Hogg, Diana Richards and Mark Lyon on 14 points. And there's 13 players on 6 points in only week one. On the admin host table, Mark Lyon top with 14. Stephen Box is in second place on his own with 6 points. Third place is Graham Ross, Deepak Gohill, Simon Holdsworth, Nathaniel James and me on 5 points. And then James and yourself, Michael Wandai, on 4 points for fourth place. So that's it.
The game is rigged.
The game is rigged in favour of Mark Lyon, who got 14 points. Suspicious. That's it for this episode of the Frequency 49 show. It is time to say goodbye, boys.
Bye, everyone.
Cheers.
On behalf of Deepak Gohill and Michael Wandai, I've been Paul McDonald. You've been the audience, and this has been the Frequency 49 show. Bye for now. Without Deepak.
Do you know what, Paul? I've done that every single time we've recorded from show one. I'm not going to stop. Admittedly, the first time I thought it wasn't being recorded, but it ended up on the outtakes.
We're going. Bye, everyone.